It is Monday, May 14th, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from the Rogers Historical Museum and Portraits in Gray, a Civil War photography exhibition featuring the collection of David Wynn Vaughn. This traveling exhibit runs through July 21st and illustrates the importance of the photographers and photographs of the period. 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum. For more information. Later on this edition of Ozarks, research at the University of Arkansas into the relationship between relationships and alcohol. And get the sunscreen and bug spray ready. Wakarusa, the four-day music festival on Mulberry Mountain, will be here before the end of the month. A preview is ahead. First, a group of Benton County residents seeking to legalize the sale of retail alcohol launched a petition drive last February to place the issue as a ballot measure before county voters in the November election. As of last week, the group, Keep Dollars in Benton County, had collected 35,000 signatures toward the necessary 40,000. Saturday, members held a drive-up sign-up day for registered voters in Bentonville, Bella Vista, Rogers, and Siloam Springs. Marshall Nye is a spokesperson for Keep Dollars in Benton County.
You know, we had a great response to the point that I believe we had the single biggest day in terms of gathering signatures that we've had since we launched the effort to get signatures. And what the precise number is today, I couldn't tell you, but I believe that we gathered more than 800 signatures on Saturday alone.
According to a study by the Sam Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas, a study funded by Keep Dollars in Benton County, retail sales of alcohol could generate as much as $33 million in sales tax revenue in the first year in startup construction and new jobs income.
Right now, of course, all of the tax dollars relating to the sale of alcohol are paid either in Washington County or another state. You know, if this makes it to the ballot, the first advantage is it'll be the first opportunity since the 1940s that the voters in Benton County will have the opportunity to be heard. And second of all, if they choose to vote in favor of Benton County becoming wet, then we'll have the opportunity to have all of those additional dollars stay home and use those dollars for essential city and county services.
The petition initiative is being funded by Stuart and Tom Walton, grandsons of Walmart Stores founder Sam Walton, and facilitated by the firm National Ballot Access. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and advocates for raising awareness of mental health issues gathered this weekend on the steps of the Arkansas State Capitol. Organizers of the event say they wanted to remind people that recovery is possible with treatment. Jennifer Gallagher oversees the Division of Behavioral Health for the Arkansas Department of Human Services.
Stigma is so evident in the state still, and we really have to work on normalizing treatment and helping people understand that it's just like any other medical condition. We get help for it. There's help out there. Treatment works, recovery happens, and we can maintain, you know, great healthy lives if we can just access the services that we need.
A new poll shows Tom Cotton opening a wider lead in the race for the Republican nomination for Arkansas's 4th Congressional District. In the latest Talk Business Hendricks College poll, the GOP newcomer had 51% of the support of likely voters in this month's primary. Beth Ann Rankin received 33% of the support. The poll of 437 likely voters in the GOP primary was conducted Thursday night. Meanwhile, many likely Democratic voters in the same district are still making up their minds, apparently. Don't know was the answer from 44% of those polled Thursday night likely to vote in the Democratic primary. The top two candidates, Q. Byram Hurst and Gene Jeffress, received 23% and 22% of the support in the poll, respectively. The Arkansas Razorback softball team is going to the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2009. Arkansas received an at-large bid yesterday and will face Boston University Friday in a regional that will be played at Berkeley, California. The Arkansas women's golf team finished in eighth place at this weekend's NCAA regional in Columbus, Ohio. That qualifies the team for the NCAA championships that will be conducted in Nashville later this month. And the Arkansas men's track and field team is the 2012 SEC Outdoor Championship squad. The Razorbacks won the title yesterday by 72 points and with the feat claimed a conference triple crown. Championships in the same academic year in cross country, indoor track and field, and outdoor track and field. The women's team finished third at the SEC meet yesterday. This is Ozarks at Large. Alcohol can alter many things: judgment, perception, and relationships. Dr. Jacqueline Viersma is an assistant professor in the School of Human Environmental Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Her research examines young adults and their romantic relationships, specifically how alcohol can have an impact on them and vice versa. Last week, she visited the Harold and Blanche Koch News studio at KUAF to talk with Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri-Madulkar about her research and how she plans to use the findings.
So my research examines young adults and romantic relationships, and specifically how alcohol affects their relationships and also how the relationships might affect their alcohol use. And what I'm really most interested in is sort of why people get into these relationships. You know, why does someone who drinks a lot of alcohol perhaps date someone who's a non-drinker, and sort of what are the consequences for their relationship? I mean, they're obviously not spending a lot of time together drinking, and does that affect their other parts of the relationship? And then, you know, someone who does drink, you know, they probably go out a lot, go to bars or clubs and meet other drinkers, and then sort of how does that affect the relationship? Does the drinking impact the relationship quality, their satisfaction, their commitment in a relationship? And also more, you know, adverse consequences like violence. You know, what can happen when you mix alcohol and, say, conflict or jealousies due to other bar patrons and things like that, how, you know, relationships can turn violent. And so my research has looked at that as well. But what I'm probably most interested in is just mate selection. Sort of, you know, about someone makes them attractive, you know? So, and, you know, how they pair up in a similar relationship versus a different type of partner. Sort of the whole idea, do birds of a feather flock together or opposites attract? There's a lot of research that shows it's mostly birds of a feather flock together for the majority of couples, but then there are some that are opposites attract, and their drinking specifically is very different. And that's very interesting to me, to understand sort of why they get in these relationships and then what happens to their relationships.
Now, how did you get started on this field of research?
Well, one thing that stuck out to me when I was working in my doctoral program is that there hadn't been a lot of research on this area. And, you know, the two most important things in young adults' lives right now are, one, romantic relationships. They're focusing on that. They're trying to develop intimacy and meet and date partners so that eventually they get married.
Right.
And the second thing is risky behaviors. They're experimenting with drugs, and specifically alcohol is the number one drug among young adults. And so the fact that these are the two most important things, how do they interact? And I don't think a lot of people think about them as interacting. And most research has looked at young adult drinking and focused on parents or peers or the college environment or things like that as influences. And my concern was, why are people forgetting about romantic partners? They're a special type of peer.
Right.
I mean, they're probably more influential, more powerful person in someone's life. And secondly, you know, most research that has examined couples and alcohol was focused on married couples. Hmm. So there has been a lot of research with Ken Leonard specifically in Buffalo, has focused on married couples and sort of how alcohol impacts their relationships and whether they're more likely to get divorced or not. But people weren't looking at dating or cohabitating or engaged couples or even single people. And I think that was what interesting to me, because young adulthood and or also called emerging adulthood, there's so many things going on in their lives with dating and drinking. And so I just wanted to understand sort of the mechanisms that were going on in that age group.
So did you go out and interview these people, or how did you collect all this data?
Good question. I did not go out and collect data. That is something I would like to do, because I think using qualitative data to ask them questions about how they get in relationships and how, you know, alcohol and other things affect them is important.
Right.
But I've been utilizing the AdHealth data set. It's the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, and it's a huge data set. It's nationally representative. There's been four waves collected over the course of 15 years or so. So at waves one and two, they were, you know, adolescents. And so I've been able to look at, you know, the adolescent behaviors and how it leads to more young adult behaviors. So, and then wave three, they're between the ages of 18 and 26. And within that age group, the 18 to 26 at wave three, they asked romantic partners. So they have 1,500 couples that were collected, and they're dating, cohabitating, engaged, and married. And so 1,500 couples, that's pretty amazing that it's nationally representative. It's right there at your fingertips to examine the drinking behaviors between these couples, and then all these other consequences like violence and sexual behaviors, health behaviors, and just in general risky behaviors among these young adults. And so that's the data set that I've been primarily working with because it's such a rich data set. Not a lot of people have looked at it. And so it's been really useful to look at longitudinal data and understand these couples first. And so that eventually I can go out and start collecting my own data with couples and that aspect.
Now, longitudinal data means that studies that have been conducted over a very long period of time, observing this particular group in 2005, for example, and then observing the same group in 2007 and then 2008.
Exactly. So with my data set, I was able to look at, say, with my dissertation, I had, you know, individuals at 15 years old, 16 years old, adolescent years, examining their drinking behaviors, their peers' drinking behaviors, their parents' drinking behaviors, all these different aspects. And then I could look at how those factors might influence their young adult drinking. And so I was able to see that it was it influenced whether they seeked out romantic drinking partners at young adulthood. So 6 years later, it was predictive that, yes, if you were a drinker in during your adolescent years, you were more likely to seek out someone in your young adult years that was also a drinking person. So basically that they were a drinker. So kind of saying that the idea of that you seek out people that are similar to yourself.
What were some of the specific questions that you set out to find answers to?
I'd say my specific questions were, I really wanted to understand, you know, do drinkers select other drinkers? There's been some research on that, and it was more specific with alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And I was focused more on general drinking. I wasn't really focusing on
alcohol abuse.
Alcohol abuse, per se. I was focused on more binge drinking, you know, four or more drinks in a row for women and five or more drinks in a row for men. And there's been so much research on that. And I wanted to know, so do young adults seek out romantic partners that drink similarly to them? And then what are the consequences if they do or they don't? So someone who's a drinker and they meet someone who's also a drinker, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And so far we found that that's a fairly good thing, that if you find someone who's like you or drinks similarly than you, there's better outcomes than, say, if you're a drinker or a non-drinker and you meet someone who, you know, drinks completely different than you. You don't basically drink at all. Then there are some consequences. Like, for example, there's more violence in those types of relationships. If someone drinks a lot, say a male drinks, you know, maybe 10 drinks on average and the female drinks one, they're more likely to have violence in their relationships.
Right.
And also, you know, they've said, you know, in those types of relationships that they're not as committed, they're not as satisfied versus the couples that drink similarly together. There's better outcomes, except if they're drinking a lot. So we have found if they're drinking really heavy, both of them, they might have some issues just because now they're drinking really heavy. And, you know, binge drinking, there's so many consequences that can arise from that.
Now, you have a treasure trove of information here. How do you plan to apply it to real life situations?
A lot of the research that looks at young adult drinking, which is, you know, a huge concern in the United States today, have focused on peers and parents and, you know, and trying to use prevention programs for them, which, you know, has found some great advantages. But I always felt with my research, I was really interested in the romantic relationships. I feel like there's such a powerful influence. I mean, think about if you've ever had a romantic partner, how you want to please them.
Right.
So if they say drink, you might want to drink more just to be around them or to make them happy. And so to me, that was someone we needed to include in prevention designs. And so right now I'm focusing my career on understanding the problem a little more developmentally and how it can impact relationships. And then, you know, understanding the longitudinal processes that go on, because yes, someday I would like to utilize some type of prevention program so that we can, you know, get at that romantic partner and help individuals discover that there's an important influence there when it comes to these drinking behaviors, that they could actually be a protective factor in some ways. They can be a negative impact on someone's life if it's a risky drinker, but they can also be a protective factor, because ultimately, once someone gets in a relationship, typically, not all the time, but drinking does go down. Like, for example, once young adults get married, there's a ton of research that shows that they're less likely to drink as much than, say, if they were single or dating. So we know a romantic partner can play an influential role, especially a protective role. So there's definitely some prevention research I'd like to do someday.
Dr. Jacqueline Viersma is an assistant professor in the School of Human Environmental Sciences at the University of Arkansas. If you'd like to listen to more from her conversation with Ithi Agnihotri-Madulkar about some surprising findings from her research, you can go to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. Springdale-based Tyson Foods released second quarter earning numbers last week, and there was a new report that shows a slight downturn in the number of people playing at Arkansas's casinos. That news and more is part of Roby Brock's Week in Review of Arkansas Business and Politics.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political stories of the last week. Tyson Foods reported second quarter net income of $166 million. That's about 6.4% higher than 1 year ago when the Springdale-based protein giant posted profits of $156 million. Revenues rose to $8.27 billion, up from $8 billion in the previous year. Tyson had solid earnings in its chicken and pork segments, but its beef division dragged on the company's bottom line as expected. Consumer broadband, business services, and net one-time charges pushed Windstream Corporation's first quarter performance higher. The Little Rock-based telecom and data provider saw its net income more than double to $64.6 million on revenues of $1.5 billion. 1 year ago, Windstream posted earnings of $29 million on revenues of a little over $1 billion. Dillard's reported first quarter net income of $95 million, a 24% increase from a year ago, when the upscale retailer reported profits of $76.7 million. Little Rock-based Dillard's saw first quarter revenues rise 5.6% to $1.55 billion during the quarter. Also, same-store sales were up 5%, the seventh consecutive quarter of same-store sales growth. After 2 months of record or near-record gambling numbers, the two casinos in Arkansas saw lower wager totals at its electronic gambling games. Still, the numbers are far above year-ago levels. In April, as its live horse racing season drew to a close, Hot Springs-based Oaklawn reported electronic games of skill wagers of $76.8 million, up nearly 40% from a year ago. At Southland in West Memphis, coin in from its electronic wagers cleared $138.8 million, a 59% rise from the previous April. Now, April's totals were the third highest month in Oaklawn history, while Southland's numbers were the fourth highest since electronic casino-style gambling began in November 2006. Year-to-date, electronic wagers at the two casinos reached $918.67 million, just shy of the billion-dollar mark. Less than 2 weeks after an improving month of state revenues was reported, Governor Mike Beebe announced an increase in the general revenue forecast for the last 2 months of the current fiscal year, which ends June 30th. Beebe said that with the adjustment, an additional $39.4 million will flow into the state budget. That will help out with a rainy day fund, as well as additional support for Medicaid and higher education institutions. The U.S. Postal Service announced a new strategy on Wednesday aimed at keeping rural post offices open while achieving some cost savings of nearly $500 million annually. The Postal Service says it's losing close to $18 billion a year. The newly announced plan would keep post offices, particularly in rural parts of Arkansas and the nation, open but with modified retail window hours to match customer use. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
Roby Brock is the publisher of TalkBusiness.net. Tomorrow on Ozarks, he'll sit down and talk with John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, about the developing topics in the state for this election year. That's tomorrow on Ozarks at Large. And in about 15 minutes on Ozarks, a tour of a new exhibit of art with the artist.
The mental awareness in painting isn't so much about thoughts like words, but more like a mental awareness of mood or an attitude.
Adam Campbell takes Jacqueline Froelich through his artistic process later on this edition of Ozarks at Large. Support for KUAF comes from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, hosting the Hudson River School, Nature and the American Vision, featuring landscape paintings depicting a time of exploration and growth in American history. This exhibition, organized by the New York Historical Society, will be on view through September 3rd. Timed reserve tickets are available online at crystalbridges.org or 418-5700. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. On May 31st, the next edition of Wakarusa takes place at Mulberry Mountain in Ozark, Arkansas. It's where band after band will play hour after hour over 4 days. And our guide to Wakarusa again this year will be Kevin Kinder from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thank you for having me, Kyle.
Should also point out that you also blog about music at...
I sure do, at nwatunedin.com.
It was there that I first learned, while I was out of town, that the stage schedule had been announced for this year's Wakarusa, and that's important because...
Well, it's important for a lot of reasons. You know, Wakarusa announced most of their lineup in January, and so we knew who was coming, but the way these festivals works is they have 4, 5, and 6 stages going simultaneously sometimes. So this is your first opportunity to find out specifically what night your favorite artist is going to be playing.
And to map your course.
I've got a map in front of me that I've highlighted and scribbled out and really done some work on to try to figure out where I want to be.
Before we talk about who you can catch when, let's talk about when you have to buy tickets. Is it too late?
No, you know, and they'll even likely sell some tickets at the gate. They're always nearing sellout, which is about 25,000 people is their
per
year is their capacity. And tickets will be sold right up until then. However, ticket prices raise on May 19th. So we're getting to that point where tickets are starting to go up. Tickets are getting more scarce. Specifically, most of the people who go down to Wakarusa, even if they're from this part of the country, go down and camp and make a weekend of it. And from what I understand from talking to some of the Wakarusa folks, some of the closest camping areas, specifically the main stage camping area and what's called Westwoods, which is the second nearest, are very nearly sold out. So if you don't buy tickets soon, you'll still be on the festival grounds, but you'll be farther away from the stages. They shuttle people in, and so it's not an ordeal, but if you want to be closer, you're running out of time.
One of the great things about a festival is that there's so many stages and so many different acts. One of the toughest things about a festival is there's so many stages and so many acts that you sometimes have to choose, do I want to be at this stage or this stage? Do you have any difficulties this year?
Yeah, I've got a couple. One of them is really sort of, I'm a indie rock fan, and if you've heard me talk before, you know that. And I think three of the bigger names under that genre are playing pretty much at the same time. That's Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros. Blitzen Trapper and the Heartless Bastards are all on stage in close proximity to each other. The Heartless Bastards have 2 shows, and so if you do it right, you can catch them once before, but it's going to be tough to choose. And
this is all on Friday night, correct?
This is all right. That's all on Friday.
That same night is starting just after 10 p.m. on the main stage. Is probably the band that seems to be getting the most attention this year, the Avett Brothers?
That's right. And they're certainly getting the most attention from me because I adore them and have watched them many times live. The first time I saw them actually was at Harvest Fest, which is a companion festival to Wakarusa. It happens at the same venue, happens in the fall, and saw them down there and absolutely fell in love. They play 10-15. They're actually in the process of creating a new album with that should be out, I would suspect, right about the time the festival happens. So
many of the acts, Heartless Bastards and many of these others that are here, so more or less some of the headliners, have been here recently.
They really have. And a lot of them, you know, like Umphrey's McGee, who has a couple sets interspersed throughout the festival. They were at George's, you know, just about a month ago for a 2-night run at that venue. Railroad Earth is through here fairly often. Pretty Lights, which is the Thursday night headliner, has played in Arkansas several times. They, you know, the Devil Makes Three, which I am pretty excited about. They're a Friday early evening band. They were just here 2 months ago. And so, yeah, you're right. And Girl Talk is another one of the bands that, that we have seen twice in the last year. In
Fort
North
Smith
Arkansas.
Last summer, Fayetteville That's just right. a few months ago. And when you compare this year's lineup to last year's, which had My Morning Jacket, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, Mumford and Sons, and some others that don't play here that often. It's a different sort of schedule this year.
It is. In fact, the bands that you mentioned all had never played in Arkansas before. My Morning Jacket, Mumford and Sons had never been in this state. And so unless they were traveling through. And to get them here, I think, was a real coup for the festival. You're right. It's a very much more comfortable schedule. This year's is. And it's a lot more familiar to people who invest time in our local music scene. If they've doing their diligence and going out to shows, they've seen a lot of these acts.
Is that part of just how schedules and who's touring falls?
You know, I think a lot of it is. And one of the things I will point out, though, Wakarusa always falls a week before Bonnaroo does.
Which Bonnaroo, is huge
Bonnaroo
festival.
Being about four times the size of our local Wakarusa festival. And last year we saw a lot of the bands who played at Wakarusa make the trip east to Tennessee the next weekend for the Bonnaroo Festival, which, you know, and that's something that My Morning Jacket did. They had headlining spots at both places. I don't see a lot of that this year, and, you know, I'm not certain what the circumstances are, but, you know, I certainly feel like some of the larger acts aren't on this year's roster.
Anybody under the radar that people who are going or considering going should pay attention to that maybe they haven't heard of?
You know, a couple that I'm really excited about is The Devil Makes Three, I mentioned a minute ago. Fits in the Tantrums. They're a neo-soul group. You know, we mentioned Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings a little bit ago. They fall in that same genre of new soul.
Feels like the star.
Another artist that I'm pretty excited about is Jason Isbell, and he has a group called the 400 Unit. Jason Isbell may not be a marquee name or may not be one that's familiar, but he played for several years in the Drive-By Truckers. And I would argue some of the best Drive-By Truckers songs are, in fact, Jason Isbell written songs. So that's a show that I'm really excited about. And one group that I think could be a lot of fun. This is one group that hasn't toured here. It's the Weir Robinson and Green Trio. And those names are Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead.
The Dead, yeah.
Chris Robinson from the Black Crows, right. And a singer-songwriter named Jackie Green. And from what I've gleaned, they haven't been performing together very long, but from what I pick up from some shows that they've done fairly recently is that they're going to do a lot of Grateful Dead songs. So it should be a really jam-heavy mm-hmm. kind of event for them.
Do you have a flag? Are you one of the people?
I actually,
you take a flag?
Yeah, you do.
What's your flag?
As a newspaper reporter, it says Scoop Troop because we're in the press camping
right.
area. And the reason you take flags, it's not as critical at Wakarusa, but especially in the part where we camp. I don't camp in the busiest and mm-hmm. most packed-in places. But, you know, in what's called Tent City, which is where the tents are side by side, you really can't leave in the 4 days. You know, there's no way out. You sort of lock yourself in. And a lot of the tents look very similar to each other. And so people bring flags that they put beside their campsite with the idea that that's the only way they're going to be able to find their unique tent.
And so you want your flag to be unique.
You want your flag to be unique. You hoist it above your tent, and that gives you – because in a sea of tents that's, you know, 300 square feet, and there are seven tents that everybody bought at Walmart the day before they went down, you've almost got to have an identifying mark, and a lot of people use flags to do that. So, yes, I do have a
– Excellent.
We are – Camp Scoop Troop. And
so now people can come up and,
that's right,
and find you if they want. Will you be blogging from there?
Yeah, you bet. We'll have we'll turn some copy for the Northwest Arkansas Media Group, but definitely we're going to have some photos and some live updates, and we try to update people too via Twitter at NWA What's Up. We'll be active with updates from the festival, including, you know, sometimes scheduling changes happen. They move somebody to a different stage. They switch because, you know, sometimes one of these bands get big in a hurry and it makes more sense to put them on a bigger stage. And so they can do those kinds of things. And we'll try to let people know what those are.
Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks, Kyle.
Kevin Kinder covers music for Northwest Arkansas newspapers. And you can read his blog about music, too. It's nwatunedin.com.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
Love letters straight from your heart.
The early 1960s hit song Love Letters was originally written by Edward Heyman and Victor Young for a 1945 Hollywood movie of the same name. The Love Letters songwriting team have quite a pedigree, with one or the other having a hand in songs like Body and Soul, I Don't Stand a Ghost of a Chance with You, I Cover the Waterfront, and You Ought to Be in Pictures. The movie Love Letters starred Jennifer Jones and Joseph Cotten. The theme song was sung by Dick Hames, who made it a pop hit. The World War II setting gave the subject matter added poignancy.
I memorize every line. I kiss the name that you sign. And darling, then I read again right from the start. Love letters straight from your heart.
And although it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Song of 1945, it was Arkansas-er Keddy Lester's version, nearly two decades later, that made Love Letters an evergreen.
Love letters straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart.
Keddy Lester was born Revoita Frierson August 16, 1934, in Hope in Hempstead County. Frierson grew up singing in church and in school choirs. She relocated to San Francisco, California while in her late teens and took the stage name Keddy Lester. After her first single fizzled, she signed with Era Records in 1961. Keddy Lester's first song for Era, I'm a Fool to Want You, didn't take off either until DJs began playing the flip side of the single. That song was called Love Letters, and it became Keddy Lester's landmark song. It hit the top five pop in the U.S. and Europe and number two on the U.S. R&B charts. Keddy Lester's international success with Love Letters, interest in the old song revived. It's been subsequently covered by artists as diverse and numerous as Elvis Presley, Rosemary Clooney, Sonny Rollins, Perry Como, Ruth Brown, Nat King Cole, Steve Lawrence, Don McLean, Ike Turner, Dinah Washington, Liberace, and here, Joe Walsh from 1983. Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols released this surprisingly faithful solo version himself in 1987.
I'm memorized every line. My kissed a name that you sang.
Kitty Lester would go on to record for other record companies, including RCA in 1964 and Capitol Records' Tower label in 1966. But she would never match the commercial success of Love Letters, the song not even intended as a single, and which instead became an international hit. From the 1970s through the 1990s, Kitty Lester did more acting than singing, although in 1984 she recorded a Christian gospel album. But no matter what she does, the Southwest Arkansas native Revorda Frierson, or Kitty Lester, will always be known for the second ever release of her career, Love Letters. Here in its entirety is Arkansas-er Kitty Lester of Hope in Hempstead County with Love Letters from 1961.
Love letters straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart. I'm not alone in the night. When I can have all the love you write, I memorize every line, and I kiss the name that you sign. Love letters straight from your heart. I memorize every line, and I kiss the name that you sign. Straight from your heart.
Kitty Lester of Hope in Hempstead County with her international early 1960s hit, Love Letters. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook. With Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Fayetteville Public Library is exhibiting new works by Adam Grant Campbell in the Walker Community Reading Room on the library's second floor. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has been tracking the Fayetteville artist since she first saw his paintings and drawings 2 years ago, and now she brings us his story.
The Walker Reading Room at the Fayetteville Public Library is a perfect place to exhibit paintings, prints, and drawings. The spacious hall is diffused with natural light and is quiet like an art museum. A half dozen patrons are in here today, surrounded by 24 abstract and small portrait paintings by Adam Grant Campbell.
Well, I prefer to work with a combination of acrylic polymer, gesso, White House primer, and work with the texture of that material, and then work with oil paint and oil painting mediums, both opaquely in layers, but also rubbing through to expose the texture underneath. There's a quality of illumination when the paint, the color of the paint is very thin and the lightness of the surface beneath the paint shines through. I've always been really attracted to that kind of glow that you see in Renaissance paintings.
Adam Campbell's experiencing his own private Renaissance after taking a sabbatical from art to study meditation, martial arts, and farming. Several years ago, he returned, enrolled as a non-traditional student at the University of Arkansas, seeking a fine arts degree, which must have been a strange thing for faculty, having a creative genius in their midst. He's graduating this month and holding this public exhibit. Campbell, who's in his 30s, is an exceptional artist and appears destined for fame, no question. He says people have expressed this to him since he was a teenager. He brushes the remark off. He spends every day in the paint, working in silence or to music. Campbell's abstract paintings are monumental and absolute, with etheric elements.
The mental awareness in painting isn't so much about thoughts, like words, but more like a mental awareness of mood or an attitude. So there's sort of there's an emotional component to the mindfulness that finds a release in the act of painting.
But once complete, each work is cathartic.
Yeah, I would have to say so. You know, reaching a point of satisfying completion with a work is definitely, there's definitely a feeling of having moved through a process and achieved what I desire to achieve. It feels very good.
A half dozen large abstract expressionist paintings line the south and west wall, beginning with the piece Grasp and Release of a skeletal hand reaching toward an indigo realm.
Four of the five phalanges, because of the color and the transition from dark to light, and especially the edge of the tips of the phalanges being such a intense chartreuse, that there's a sense of like energy being released from the contrast of the light and the dark.
Adam Grant Campbell is adept at painting iridescence. One other abstract looks to be a brilliant portal.
The gateway. Yeah, that started out a very loose acrylic, black on white. It's a very rapid brushwork. But I like the composition, and I like the feeling that there is an interior space suggested even within a very obscure kind of atmosphere.
But Adam Campbell identifies himself mainly as a portrait artist, and he's hung 17 of them here in this hall. Impressionist close-ups, primarily head and shoulders, lit from above, beneath, or square on, eyes often hidden deep in shadow. Few smiling, expressions in repose, you know, like no one's watching. Few are pleasant. Campbell does not take vanity into account.
There was a portrait of a young woman that I did, and she was immediately in denial that it looked like her. And she did not want to look at it. And I was able to talk her into keeping it in her house for a month or so, so that she could live with it. And we talked after she'd had it for a while. And she told me that, you know, at first she didn't want to see that it was her, but then she realized that it did look like her. And I think it expressed a feeling that was very strong and not something that she was very aware of.
Campbell knew the subject personally and painted what he saw, concentrated vision. Each portrait seems to be a story of colorful emotion shifting between the painter and the painted. Up close, the brushstrokes melt into abstraction. From a distance, become photorealistic.
When they pose, it's just pretty much the same expression that you see in almost all grand manner portraits or any kind of like traditional portrait. Like, people can't hold their face in a position for a long time. It just eventually goes slack. And so what you're left with is the the general demeanor of that person. You know, like the way the lines on their face, the way the muscles have developed to give their face either a look of, you know, friendliness or sadness or whatever their main emotion is that they carry with them throughout their lives.
Amazingly, most of the portraits hanging here have been quickly rendered. An exercise Campbell titled 20 Portraits, 40 Days, a warm-up for his next project.
And I thought I would do a series of 360 portraits of various leaders in the Fayetteville area, and then kind of document who they are and what they're doing, and create sort of an ebook that would be the work of art where people could flip through the portraits like albums and listen to the people talk about their vision and what they're doing as a leader. And I love the idea, but I don't have the resources immediately to make that happen. And rather than let the project go stale, I thought of a way that I could go ahead and initiate the project in pieces instead of trying to get it funded all at once. And that's what led me to the idea of the Hive, of painting a series of portraits of different groups of people who are working together towards some aspect of community development.
Some collectives he's decided to paint are of hospice workers at Washington Regional Medical Center, a local farm cooperative, a group of other artists. Collectives will be painted in a thematic hue, each person on a 16-by-16 hexagonal panel, assembled into large honeycomb formations. The project will require lots of paint and canvas, so will require financial resources. To that end?
Well, there are websites like Kickstarter.com and Indiegogo that provide a crowdfunding platform, and I plan on putting together a short promotional video about the project and making it available on Kickstarter so that people that are interested in seeing the project happen can fund it. And I've also got a list of rewards. Of course, that's how they put it on the website, that people receive depending upon how much they donate.
And an Adam Grant Campbell portrait will likely one day fetch a great deal of money. By the way, he works on commission if you wish to participate in American art history in making. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A reception for Adam Grant Campbell is scheduled May 17th from 5:30 until 7:30 p.m. The exhibit will hang through June 3rd. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to adamgrantcampbell.com. Fayetteville Public Library's Art Committee, formed 7 years ago, made up of art patrons and artists, chooses the exhibiting artist. The public library is located at the corner of Mountain and School Streets in downtown Fayetteville.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 14th of May, 2012. May the 14th, 1787, was the day on which the Constitutional Convention was scheduled to convene in Philadelphia. They were going to correct the flaws of the Article of Confederation and form a more perfect union. There was great concern over the articles. They didn't provide against foreign attacks or defend against encroachments or secure harmony between the states. George Washington said the articles were liable to be overturned by every blast. But when May the 14th arrived, only 8 of the 55 delegates were there. There was some bad weather. They were held up. By May the 25th, there were finally enough delegates present, 30 of them, and things got started. One of the first things the Constitutional Convention established was a rule of secrecy, that nothing spoken in the House be printed or communicated without leave. They required the windows to stay shut with heavy draperies. And there was hot weather that summer, so it was uncomfortable for the delegates who were formally dressed and bewigged and powdered. The first big argument was about representation. The Federalists from the large wealthy states believed that the share in government should be based on wealth and population. The Anti-Federalists from the smaller states believed each state should have an equal say. Neither of them would back down. And finally, the Connecticut Compromise, a bicameral legislature. In the upper house, the Senate, each state would have two votes, proportional representation in the lower house. They also worked out whether the presidency would be a single office or divided among three people, what would constitute an impeachable offense, how federal judges were to be appointed. It took them 4 months, but they produced the United States Constitution, and 39 of them signed it. It was on this day in 1796 the first safe smallpox vaccine was administered. It was a devastating illness. In the 18th century alone, it claimed the lives of 60 million people. It was Edward Jenner, an English doctor, who heard a milkmaid brag that she could never catch smallpox because she'd already caught cowpox, which was related to smallpox but was much milder. So Jenner injected fluid from a cowpox sore into the arm of James Phipps, 8 years old, and 6 weeks later injected him again, this time with live smallpox, and the boy showed no symptoms. Jenner called the practice vaccination, after the Latin word vacca, for cow. Here's a poem for today by Marilyn Donnelly, On Mondays. On Mondays, when the museums are closed and a handful of guards look the other way or read their newspapers, all of the figures step out of golden frames to stroll the quiet halls or visit among old friends. Picasso's twisted ladies rearrange themselves to trade secrets with the languid odalisques of Matisse, while sturdy Rembrandt men shake the dust from their velvet tams and talk shop. Voluptuous Renoir women take their rosy children by the hand to the water fountains, where they gossip while eating Cézanne's luscious red apples. Even Van Gogh, in his tattered yellow straw hat, seems almost happy on Mondays when the museums are closed. Marilyn Donnelly's poem On Mondays from Coda, published by Autumn House Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, offering online review monitoring and management services for businesses that know the importance of online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Nook, Simple Touch with Glow Light by Barnes & Noble. Designed for bedtime reading, Glow Light offers paper-like reading with the lights on or off. Available at neighborhood Barnes & Noble stores or Nook.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. White River Nursery is now offering over 50 varieties of trees for spring planting, as well as vegetables, herbs, seeds, and supplies. 442-2061 or on the web at whiterivernursery.com for more information. This is KUAF Public Radio, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Springdale, your NPR affiliate for the past 28 years. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow on KUAF.